Now, over the years, there have been several movements to change the William & Mary alma mater. Why have there been these movements?
Well, it was the latter part of the 50s and early 60s, I think, where it was the biggest movement on that. It seemed that some of the alumni didn't like the present alma mater, which is used by so many other colleges and high schools and just almost everybody, but they write the write different words. And so there was a serious movement by the student association, somebody, so everybody on the faculty tried his hand at writing an alma mater, and William & Mary of Norfolk, there was one man down there wrote an alma mater. Of course, we handed them around, we played them for each other, and we didn't say who had written this and so on. And even just for experimentation, the one that I wrote, we took out on tour one time, and we'd end the program that way. And I'd asked the William & Mary alumni who were in the audience, how'd you like that? And well, they said it was all right, but I think what's finally happened, so many of the alumni liked the William & Mary hymn better than the alma mater. Yet those people who have graduated with this particular alma mater, and I just don't think they'll ever let it go, and so this whole movement just died away. What we did after this, right at the time when they decided, well, we'll hang on, we always ended our concerts with the William & Mary hymn and with the transition into the alma mater, and that seems to satisfy all the alumni. So we worked out I wrote a brief introduction, which goes into the hymn, and then made a modulation and transition to the alma mater, and there has been no more disturbance about it. I suppose it's very, very difficult to change an alma mater. I know that in my high school days we ran into the same problem, and of course the alma mater which the high school had was almost unsingable because of the range and so forth. And they did go into a campaign to write a new alma mater, and the man who directed the band down in our high school wrote one, and the students accepted it, and all the former students. Now that's sort of unusual. You hardly hear of anybody changing the alma mater. Being from Texas, we have the Eyes of Texas, which is based on, I've been working on the railroad, and I've been taking a lot of ribbon and all that, but I was just thinking, at the time when we were trying to change the alma mater to William & Mary, I think you'd have to move the whole state of Texas to change that to alma mater. And it seemed to me, after talking to some of the alumni, showing them, and I've played some of these various contributions made for our new alma mater, and they'd always, after we through with these, they'd shake their head. Says, no, let's stay with the old one. It's just something you get used to. It's just like a piece of apparel or a dress or a suit that you like to wear. You don't care how raggedy it looks, you still want to wear it. And I think this is probably I doubt if William & Mary will ever change its alma mater.
You had spoken of involvement in the Common Glory. How long were you director for the Common Glory Choir?
Well, the Common Glory started in 1947, and I stayed with the Common Glory through 1967. Mm-hmm. This was very interesting, the beginning of the Common Glory. Mr. Paul Green wrote the show, and the first years of the Common Glory, the choir was mainly William & Mary students from the William & Mary Choir. And we had a most delightful experience in the early years because we were working together, and we just had whereas the choir was open to anybody, we didn't have as many people trying out for the choir.
This is the Common Glory Choir.
The Common Glory Choir. And these people were paid. And the good thing about the Common Glory Choir is the students who were in the choir could also take some summer courses. And in 1947, thereabouts, we had a lot of men returning from their duty in the services. And they were older men, and this was giving them a little of money. They didn't get paid very much. But at the same time, we'd have our singing group. We had 33 singers in the early days, and then they reduced it to 30, and I think they have around 20 now in the Common Glory. And as time went on, the personnel was drawn from various college life, as Madison, Baldwin, Mary Baldwin, Randolph Macon University of Richmond, West Hampton, and even from the Carolinas, and some people would come from far, far distant. And like in my days, when I was choir director, we always had choir rehearsals and tried to make this sort of a choral school, but that aspect and that idea has disappeared now. And as the show went on, the members of the choir also were put on stage. In the early days, the choir was just choir, that's all. But as they had financial difficulties, they gave people double duties. And of course, when they signed the contract for working in the Common Glory, they knew that they had to move scenery or they had to do some acting and so. And also, it gave them a little more to do, because in the early days, the choir would be on stage for a while and then they have nothing to do. Of course, some the girls would knit and sew and gossip, I guess, and the fellows would they used to play a lot of pinochle and things like that, and so just as well be useful. And so we had quite a few. We had even as many between 100, 150 and 200 people trying out for choir. Oh, just 30, and so you had quite a bit of a talent from which to choose. And as I said, we had a choral school. We'd rehearse every day for 2 hours in the afternoon, and the students really learned a lot. And a lot of people would come to work in the Common Glory to get this choral experience. And of course, when it's not maybe very nice to say, but when you took that aspect away, a lot of students who were interested in music didn't care to come to sing in the Common Glory, because it gets pretty drab to sing for 60 nights the same music without having a change. And what we would do in my day, always have a warm-up in which we would talk over the show. And I would tell these students, I said, here people are paying their hard-earned money, $3, $4, $5 to see the show. I want them to put on a professional job. And I said, I don't care if you feel badly, you forget it, and you get on the stage and put this thing across. I said, it's sort of like on Broadway where they give a show out for years every night. Those people have to be sparked and do it, particularly when people are paying them money. And I would spark them by giving them music that wasn't just the same songs that were sang in the Common Glory, so that they wouldn't get tired of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always be very picky and find some little thing wrong with the song so as to pep them up, and instead of just being like a phonograph record going over and doing it sloppily or inadequately and so on. And of course, we had some experimentation in the Common Glory. For a while, we had recorded music and organ, live organ. Then later on, we had live choir and recorded organ. And if you don't think that's difficult to sing that way, because when you have anything recorded, it's set. And of course, some of the highlights of my Common Glory work were when we had live organ and live choir working together, and we had some fine organists. One of the best ones we ever had was Mr. William Waters. He was with the Common Glory about 10 years. In the early days, we had people who were in the choir as much as 10 years, and that's giving up 10 summers to be in. And of course, as I was at 21 years, I just never had any vacation. And because after Common Glory, college started. And years, because of the financial problems that the Commodores had and the different point of view of the importance of the choir, naturally things have changed a lot, and quite a bit of interest in choir as such has changed. And of course the adjustments had to be made to make, keep the show going and include the music and the emphasis on doing the choral music just as fine as possible. Probably has changed some. Yeah, of course, every director has his ideas how the music should be done. This is no criticism. This is absolutely a fact. Whereas people would do, as I said, we had fine organists, and for several years we had an orchestra, and that was very nice because we would also do music together. The organ and the choir would do some music other than Commodore music, and we'd give concerts. And they would memorize all the music, and we would have a streetcar conductor's holiday. We'd go on the night off, we would give our concert, and the students were, or the people that were singing in the Commodore choir knew that we were going to do this, and so we didn't have anybody that was griping about, and they were required to be there. And all of this was made clear to them. I think any time you have any kind of organization of any merit, you've got to let them know, just like a good football team. A person can't say, well, I'm going to come and play if I want to or not. And this is the same attitude we had about our choir work.
Okay.
But the Commodore was quite an experience. We made some records, and we've got some good recordings of the music. And they sang some very fine music, and we had some really wonderful, really fine voices. So that was one big highlight of my life, Commodore.
Okay. Can I ask you some questions now about the Farewell Fest?
Yes.
How was it that, let me ask first, whose idea was the Farewell Fest? Do you know?
Well, I'm not quite sure. Ever since I've been here, since 1945, we've had many choir alum come back to see us, my wife and me and so on. And I suppose when people knew that I was going to retire, some of the people in the later years, one young man graduated in 1957, Mr. Agamemnon Vassas, thought it'd be nice that we'd have some sort of choir reunion. We had several choir reunions, but they really wanted to make a choir reunion because of this exit that I was making from the college. So they thought it'd be a good time for them to get together and do a little singing. And also it afforded a time where many former students could get together and see each other again that hadn't seen each other for years. And it was very, very interesting. So a committee was formed, particularly of people who were in this area. And there were several people like Mrs. Harkin and Joe Phillips and Nancy Stanton. Mr. and Mrs. Kogel, who met in the choir, were married in the choir, were a result of their association in the choir, but were married. Then we took three people from the present-day choir, Ann Spielman, Tom Terry, and Keith Savage. I think that's the entire committee. I hope I haven't missed anybody. But those people got together and did the planning, and the young man that really did the most work was Tom Terry. He was our alumni secretary, and Anspin was secretary of the choir, and Keith Savage was the president of the present-day choir. They really did work, but Tom Terry spent hours and nights, and they had worlds of correspondence, and the committee met, and they worked out the entire festival. And it was the most delightful occasion and a memorable occasion for my wife and me. There were close to 200 alumni came. The choir and chorus gave their concert. And then after that, we didn't give a full concert because we also had the alumni choir came in on Saturday morning, May the 4th, for rehearsal. And they had some activities in the afternoon, and there was a banquet, and then we had our concert, and after the concert, there was the, some activity, a few speeches in connection with my retirement, and it was quite a red letter day in the life of my wife and me, and of course of our students. It was a difficult time because the attachment that I have had with my students, and we didn't want it to be a sob affair, because after all, people do come to the end of the line, and we kept it that way. And students were, one student I hadn't seen in 27 years, and it was interesting for these people to come. Some of them brought their children along, and it really was a very, very delightful occasion. We had one young man who plays so very well, who was my accompanist in 1960, Tracy Russell. He presented a piano number at that occasion. He was fine. He's quite an artist and plays very beautifully. Did a piano number. And in 1960, we did Two Saints Cecilia by Adela Joe, and he was the accompanist. And when he left, he said to me, "Pappy, when you retire, let's try to do this together, and I'll play the accompaniment." So we had sort of a long-standing date, and I decided I'd like to sing that. It's a very moving number, and the students got a big charge out of it, and of course, we all got a charge out of having Tracy to play our accompaniment. So, that was a big day.
Okay. Is there any thought of keeping the alumni choir together the way the alumni band comes back at homecoming every year?
Well, they, after the farewell fest, several students had written me and said, "It's too bad that we had it only one day. They should really have it for 3 days." And what they want is really that they could visit together.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they'd like rehearse. The thing is, we really should have had a couple of days together to rehearse, mm-hmm. because it was really amazing how well they sang, and we had the average about 20 minutes per number, and we sang around 5 numbers. And with all the other things that go on, you don't have much time to polish and to really perfect, but they did sing very well. And satisfying thing was that so many of them said to me, well, they remembered all the little things that I had taught them, how to pay attention and so forth, and therefore we worked together very, very quickly. And many of these people that had gone, are now choir directors in their community, in their churches, or other little community courses, so that they felt that their training was worthwhile. Of course, it makes me feel good. I don't know whether they really learned so very much, but some things people do learn to pick up by just associating with music and how it's supposed to be done. Also, I guess I should mention this, the alumni group had contributed a fund to form the Carl A. Fair Choral Library, and what they had done, they had made arrangements with the audiovisual department to make copies of all the tapes that we have. Now we have some, it's not complete because evidently some tapes were misplaced, stolen, or some things we didn't record, and so we are agreeing to making this library up of all the tapes we possibly have, and I'm sure not many people are ever going to listen to them, but in case anybody would want to. And I'm quite distressed in my work with them that there are some tapes I just simply cannot find, and I thought I had them. But we have just a world of tapes of our Christmas concerts, spring concerts, other events concerts, but we just won't back 1,000% on this because I've even written to former students. And of course, you must remember in 1945 and the early 60s, the taping wasn't as professional as it is now, and so some of the recordings aren't too good because of the technical pickup that we had. That was due to the fact that tape had just come along, and we didn't have the equipment either. We made some early recordings on wire, we had really bad luck on some of that because of the wire. We got loose of the spoon. We just had wire everywhere, and so we couldn't preserve some of those. And of course, in the very early days, they had this soft wax records, and of course, they would, after a couple of playings, they would be scratchy and worn out. So some of the things we just don't have recorded. We just talk about it.
But you have all these recordings of all these 1,000 concerts you gave, and it doesn't even take into account all the rehearsals and all that we've talked about, and all these 4 sessions that we've had. It's really...
It's been real rewarding. I'll pick up a recording that we made in the 50s and play it, and it brings back so many memories, and the group sang quite well. And every now and then a student will come by to see me, and they say, I wonder, could I hear this particular recording of our concert? And I'd get it out, and you would see them, how they'd smile, they'd remember things. Mm-hmm. One of the most difficult things I have is people coming back, and they'll ask me about little incidents that happened that were very meaningful to them and were moments of pleasure to them in that particular year. And the hard thing for my wife and me is to spot people. They come in and we can't really say, now, were you here in 1947? Were you here in 1953? And were you here? So we always ask them when they were here. And of course, most of the people, the young men could be in that 4 years, and the young ladies were usually 3 years, you see. And so they all have their little remembrances of where they had delightful experiences and so forth. Of course, we had our moments when everything wasn't just happy and rosy and delightful, but that's the way things go. You're not everything pleasant all the time. They weren't very happy with the director all the time. They probably, if some of the dormitories could speak, there would be some very, very funny things that come out of the walls. I said that I've kidded some of my students. The reason that the various dormitories are being renovated because some of the miserable things that were said about the choir and the choir director have cracked the foundation and the walls, and they have to repair them again. But all of us in jest. In general, we got along pretty well. People who didn't want to work and didn't want to live under a certain FAIR discipline just would never found their place in the choir or chorus, because I still maintain you cannot sing beautifully and put on some program with class and excellence and with spark and enthusiasm and precision and so on, unless you have a certain discipline and a desire and not just sing through a thing, but really cause a moving experience for the audience and the listener. You're not going to, not everybody in any audience, I don't care if they go to the Metropolitan or anywhere, they're not all going to come out elated. But we just received a Christmas card from an elderly lady, and she said that the one thing that she regrets about my retirement is that the Christmas concert was always a prelude to her happy Christmas. I'm quoting her, and this makes me feel awfully good that it feels like that maybe I did contribute something to that lady's life. And also, for many students, the Christmas cards we get, they say at this time they always think of their Christmas concert and how they had inspired them for a happy Christmas. Well, I know that sounds in bragging, but the thing is, my idea always was your music should be a happy moment for you and give you a lift in any way. And if it didn't, then you shouldn't waste your time.
Well, you've been talking about contributions. The choir, I appreciate your contributing to this, and I'd like to come and look over your scrapbooks with you.
Good. And we may have more to talk about.
We may have more to talk about and turn it off.
You want to tell the date?
December December 17th, 1975. You were just now showing me a clipping about the Fair Scholarship Fund. Now, how did that come about?
Well, in 1966, the president of our choir was John Cole, and he had talked with Dr. Pascal about creating a choral scholarship in honor of me, and of course I was very flattered and honored about they thought of this, and my wife said, this is unusual, says usually they do this after somebody is dead and gone, and I told her that I was happy that I could experience seeing some people receive this money. The initial corpus that we had was $5,000, and that nobody could ever take that. We take the interest and establish a scholarship from that. And we established a $200 per year scholarship, or we could divide them into two $100. It doesn't sound like much money, but every little bit helps a student. And this fund now has grown to the extent that we can give three scholarships of $300 each. And when the scholarship is not awarded, that the interest goes into the corpus, and so they'll build up. And it's mainly designed to encourage people to be in the choral groups, and we say that they must participate in the choral organizations. And this was really quite exciting for us to have this established, and it's nice to see it go on since 66, so now obviously 1975 is 9 years, and we've helped some real worthy students, and they're very appreciative, even though it's not very much. It doesn't come into $1,000, but it helps them with their books and with their fees.
Were the people who helped set it up members of the alumni choir?
Well, the ones that set up were the choir in 1966.
That's right. Okay. Uh-huh.
And we have every now and then people send in a contribution to the fund, and I just think it's worthwhile, even though it doesn't yield an awful lot for a scholarship.
Very fine honor, though. Yeah. Very fine.